Welcome back to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. You have no doubt heard that saying, life is what happens to you when you're busy making other plans. The life of my next guest could serve to illustrate the wisdom of that line. He indeed had other plans. As a romantic 20-year-old, he thought about dying young and becoming immortal like Buddy Holly or James Dean, with people leaving bouquets at his grave and mourning the loss of his enormous, complicated talent. But life happened. He didn't die tragically young, and his talent was not lost to the world. Instead, Garrison Keillor is 71 and about to mark the 40th anniversary of his radio show, A Prairie Home Companion. To celebrate this milestone, Keillor has a new book, The Keillor Reader, an anthology of his stories, essays, poems, and much more. Garrison Keillor, it's so good to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you, Cynthia.
You know, it is enlightening and, dare I say, reassuring to read your book, especially that introduction, and learn that if someone had told the 20-year-old Garrison Keillor he was going to reach millions of people through his radio show and his writing, it seems that that 20-year-old would have been pretty astounded.
I would have run in the other direction, of course. I would have taken off for some place where there are not 4 million people.
You know, it is interesting when I think of all the students I know, the new grads I've talked to, wrestling with that question, what do I do now that I'm getting out of college, and what do I do when I grow up? It seems, just from reading your introduction to The Keillor Reader, it's reassuring because life does not take us in nice straight lines, does it?
Be prepared to be lucky. This is my advice. Blind, stupid luck. Things that you never could have planned that wouldn't have come to you had you worked your way in a straight line towards them.
And here you are with the 40th anniversary coming of A Prairie Home Companion. And it does seem that not fitting in with the rest of the kids as you were growing up, that really led you to find your gift, didn't it, of sitting at a typewriter? Well, first starting with your pencil and pad of paper.
Well, I don't know that I had a gift. People thought I did at the time because I was shy and I didn't make eye contact and I liked to, you know, sit off by myself, which is not really a sign of talent. But I had an odd talent. I think I had persistence, which is a sort of talent, and the ability to throw things away that I myself had written. The editorial urge was always strong with me. I think that's one of the hardest things for a writer to learn how to do, is to edit yourself. You have to be able to stifle about a third of what you might otherwise do. A good instrument of self-repression is handy.
The very first thing that you share with us when we open up The Keillor Reader is something that, in your words, you describe as a letter that changed my life and rescued me from despair. Tell us about that letter and especially why it was so important that it be the first thing we read in your newest book.
I sent off four stories to the New Yorker magazine, 25 West 43rd Street, New York, New York, and they just went off in a manila envelope addressed to the editors, no cover letter or anything. And there was a young woman, I don't remember her name, she was a graduate of Bryn Mawr, and she was hired as a first reader, and she sat in a dim room looking at piles and piles of stories, sitting there in a cashmere sweater and smoking, chain smoking. And she pulled out one of my stories and she passed it up to the editor, fiction editor, Roger Angel, and he read it and liked it and he sent me a letter accepting a story of mine for The New Yorker, which I had been reading since I was 13. And I sat down on the doorstep of my house, and I was stunned. And I thought, well, now my life is not entirely wasted. Now something good has happened. And out of that woman whose name I can't remember, her choice of my story, came all sorts of things. And had it not been for her, I don't know what I would be doing. I'd be a rural mail carrier. a very frustrated rural mail carrier, and you know, wondering why I never wrote a novel.
You know, looking at what is in the Keeler Reader, and it forced you to appraise your own work and to plow through 50 years of your writings to decide what should be in this anthology. How did that feel?
It felt unnatural. I don't do that as a rule. I don't sit around looking at my stuff and admiring it. I don't look at it for fear I might find a typographical error. And so I forced myself to do it. It was a job, you know, and you just sit down. And I chose these pieces because I thought if somebody made me read them out loud, I would not be embarrassed. That was my criterion. And so it was interesting to take a novel. I wrote a novel called Pontoon, and it originated with a Lake Wobegon monologue on the radio show about a pontoon boat with 24 Lutheran pastors on it that sank in shallow water. And from that story, I created a novel that then, in putting together this book, I reduced back to an elaborate version of the original monologue. So it's a reconstituted story.
It's as if having clay and being able to throw it on the potter's wheel and make different things out of that same piece of clay. You know, one of the things that you tell us about in the Keeler Reader is an assignment from the New Yorker magazine to write about the Grand Ole Opry. And for those who may never have heard of the genesis of A Prairie Home Companion, how did that lead to the radio show?
I went down to Nashville. I'd been there once before to see the Opry because I listened to it now and then up in Minnesota. In the wintertime, you could get the AM radio signal pretty well from WSM down in Nashville. I went down there to see the Opry, and it just struck me, hanging around backstage, that those people were having a wonderful time. Minnie Pearl was there, and Chet Atkins, and Roy Acuff, and Stonewall Jackson. Dolly Parton was there. She did a commercial for Beechnut Chewing Tobacco, which was really memorable. And hard to believe that she knew about chewing tobacco, but but she made us think that she did. And Porter Wagner and all of them. And it just dawned on me that I should go back to Minnesota and start a show like that, because they were just having too good a time to let them be the only ones to enjoy it.
So one more.
So I did. I started it, you know, in innocence and ignorance, and without ignorance, you know, where would we be?
So true. And had you even thought of yourself as a radio guy before then?
I had been a radio guy in a studio playing classical music and saying, and that was the Serenade for Strings in C Major by Tchaikovsky.
Oh, I can totally hear you do that.
Right. And now we turn to music of J.S. Bach. I had done that, but I had never done anything on a stage before. So it was a big step, but I was 32, and when you're 32, you're full of unreasonable confidence.
And you had evolved from that kid that couldn't look people in the eye.
You don't have to look people in the eye.
It's true.
In radio. You just you look at their foreheads.
How did writing for your own radio program, basically with yourself to please and not an editor in New York, how did that affect your voice in your writing?
Well, I don't know how it affected the writing, but I knew that I had to write the show. I didn't at the beginning. It was simply a musical variety show, and I just introduced people and, you know, asked them simple questions. Mm. And but I wanted to introduce some sketch comedy, and eventually I did, and we hired actors, and that changed the show a great deal. Writing for writing for other people's voices was a big adventure for me, and I worked hard to try and figure it out. And then early on, I started telling stories about a small town, Lake Wobegon, where all the women are strong and the men are good looking, and the children are above average. And that I never expected would turn into a steady line of work. But there it is. That you create your magnum opus without being aware of what you're doing.
And then all of a sudden you look and you say, wait, 40 years? How did that happen?
What? Yeah, exactly.
Garrison, we invited Michigan Radio listeners to send in some questions to ask you. We were working it in our Facebook page. So you kind of did answer this, maybe jokingly, but maybe seriously. And someone wants to know, if you had not ended up in the business of radio and writing, what other profession could you have seen yourself pursuing and enjoying?
My parents wanted me to be a teacher, but I just could not have done it. It's just much too hard, and it's exhausting work. My dad worked in the post office, and I think maybe that's where I would have gone. I've always found it sort of satisfying to file things and to put them into some order and to take a handful of mail and separate it into four different piles. I've always gotten satisfaction from it. Not embarrassed by that. And to be a rural mail carrier, I think could have been okay. You know, you drive and you sort of sit over on the right-hand side of the car so you can, slip the bundles of mail into the boxes and your day goes by and you lead a normal life. I'm at this point sort of curious what a normal life would be like.
Well, it's funny, when I looked at the schedule, you have an intense schedule coming up to promote the Keeler Reader, so you won't be having anything normal for a while as you are all over America promoting your new book. Here's another question. What's your favorite character to play on A Prairie Home Companion?
Oh, Guy Noir. I like to be Guy Noir. I get to do just a little bit of an Eastern, slightly noirish voice, And he's somebody who I definitely am not, and so that's fun. He's not nostalgic. He's not, he's not a public radio guy. He's not a sensitive, caring American male. He's a man who's beset with failure, especially when it comes to women, and he's a great admirer of women.
Garrison, the Midwest, of course, plays such a big part in A Prairie Home Companion. It's almost literally a character on the show. What does being a Midwesterner mean to you?
I think that we are industrious people. We are secretive people. We were brought up to keep a lid on it and not to make a spectacle of ourselves. We were brought up to work by, to communicate by implication. We're minimalists. We're Stoics. That's kind of a cliche, but I think there's a lot of truth to it. Midwesterners travel well, I think, and I run into them when I go to Europe. I run into them out east and down south and out west, and they travel well because they don't demand recognition. They blend in well, and they're very productive people. We don't abide time wasters. We're not slackers, I think, by and large. I mean, there's a lot of individual leeway possible, but that's who I think we are. We're basically farm people, even though we've lived in cities for generations.
From where you sit and you look at this 40-year span of A Prairie Home Companion, how do you think radio has changed in these 40 years and the program itself?
Well, radio seems to me to be in flight from itself, and it's trying to think of itself as a as a platform, as new media in a way. It's odd. What they're aiming for is kind of audio wallpaper, and either news or music, but all about format and not about the individual voice. They're afraid of the individual voice, as committees have always been, and they're leading us down the wrong path. I feel that very strongly. A Prairie Home Companion was out of step 40 years ago, and it's even more so now. And yet, there are all these people who listen to it. Why is that?
Yeah.
It's because the strongest part of radio is the individual voice. Not me, not you, but the individual voice. And when I tune on in the radio, when I'm driving around, I need some company. I turn my tuning knob in the car to find somebody who's talking to me.
The Keeler Reader, which is being released to celebrate the 40th anniversary of A Prairie Home Companion. We know you've got a big three-day celebration coming up on July 4th, 5th, and 6th, so we'll have that to look forward to. But in the meantime, here is this wonderful anthology of your writing. And it really has been a pleasure to talk with you, Garrison Keeler. Thank you so much for joining us on Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia.
I hear that old piano from down the avenue. I smell the popcorn, I look around for you. Oh, my sweet, sweet, sweet someone, coming through that door. It's Saturday and the band is playing. Honey, could we ask?